Good afternoon, Juno. It's almost 3 p.m. and time for another edition of A Juno Afternoon. I'm Ken Fix. I'm going to be your host for today. And on the show, we'll get an update on the Whale Project from Kathy Rudy and Jim Clark as part of our City and Borough of Juno Department Profile Series. This is the third one. We'll get a report on the Juno Police Department from Chief Bryce Johnson. We'll speak with Sarah Lindstone about the African Children's Choir and their concerts here in early September. And the new teaching and learning director, Ted Wilson, will be here to talk about the Juno School District's report card to the public. These guests, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and a lot more for Tuesday, August 26, 2014. Stay tuned. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. It's been a year since the Bureau of Indian Affairs gave the green light to the Menominee Tribe's proposal for an off-reservation casino in Kenosha, Wisconsin. As WXPR's Natalie Jablonski reports, Governor Scott Walker has yet to weigh in on the plan.
Governor Walker has said he wants all of the state's 11 tribes to support the project before he says yes. The Forest County Potawatomi community has staunchly opposed the plan. The tribe already has a casino in the Milwaukee area. Spokesperson George Ermert says the gaming market is saturated and will draw dollars out of state.
The Potawatomi remain confident that Governor Walker is going to find that ultimately it is not in the best interest of the state to approve a project that sends hundreds of millions of Wisconsin dollars down to Florida.
The Kenosha Casino would be financed and managed by Hard Rock International, owned by the Seminole Tribe of Florida. Chairman of the Menominee Kenosha Gaming Authority, Gary Besaw, says the Hard Rock brand will draw more people, and he says profits will still mainly benefit local communities around Kenosha and where it's badly needed on the reservation.
The primary beneficiary of the revenue are the Menominee people. So we see the boon economically and in jobs also in Northeast Wisconsin. This is a win-win all the way around.
The Menominee Tribe says it's hopeful about Walker's decision, which is set to come in February. For National Native News, I'm Natalie Jablonski.
Attorneys are set to argue before the Alaska Court of Appeals about whether Yupik fishermen who fished during a closure were wrongfully convicted. Due to a reduced run of king salmon, the state had closed the Lower Kuskokwim River subsistence fishery in the summer of 2012. Fishing for king salmon is a key part of Yupik culture. Dozens of people allegedly fished in defiance of the state closure. Many were given fines and some nets were confiscated. 13 decided to pursue an appeal. Attorneys for the fishermen argue that the state should have tried to accommodate the fishermen's religious beliefs. The state argues that issuing citations for fishing during an emergency closure was needed to protect king salmon. The trial court agreed that fishing is part of Yupik religion, but convicted the fishermen, deciding Alaska's need to protect king salmon overrode their religious rights. Arguments are scheduled to begin today. Hundreds of children on a South Dakota reservation are going back to school with new supplies, with the help from Native families and a local group. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
The Cheyenne River Youth Project put together the back-to-school kits for students on the Cheyenne River Reservation in western South Dakota. The packages include backpacks, calculators, compasses, and mechanical pencils. The Youth Project is funded in part by families on the reservation. Those families pay $30 to the organization every year. In return, they get to take part in annual distributions, including a Christmas toy drive, household supplies, baby items, and winter clothing. A spokesperson for the Cheyenne River Youth Project says many donations for school supplies come from the group Running Strong for Indian Youth, based in Alexandria, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. Numerous individual donors donated to the project as well. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
The Métis Nation of Ontario adopted a declaration to end violence against Aboriginal women during its General Assembly this week in Thunder Bay. A resolution was also passed for Métis leaders to write the Canadian government and call for a national investigation into cases of missing and murdered Aboriginal women. Leaders say underlying problems and contributing factors need to be examined on why Aboriginal women are more vulnerable than others in mainstream society. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Bonjour, Jitabayge Siguanananduwiandwa, Mawadishuin, healthcare.gov/tribal, Yemaganoj 1-800-318-2596, Gawundinagade, Dissenters for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And the Juno Afternoon begins with our first guests in the studio, Kathy Rudy and Jim Clark, and they are here with the Whale Project update. Now, for those who don't know what the Whale Project is, Kathy, why don't you explain to our listeners what it is?
All righty. Thank you so much for the invitation to come on the show. 7 or 8 years ago, it seems, Bill Overstreet, the then mayor, Skip Wallen, who I think everyone knows as a sculpture of these amazing, the Windfall Fishermen over by the courthouse and the Gang of Four at DIPAC, collaborated on a project of a life-scale bronze humpback whale and fountain. And it was to be in honor of the 50th anniversary of statehood. And it still is and will be dedicated in honor of the 50th anniversary of statehood, even though it won't be placed for several years later. But the Windfall Fishermen over by the courthouse there, the big bear that everyone climbs on and does their ALS bucket challenges in front of, was for the 25th anniversary of statehood, and it didn't get placed until several years after. But in any event, it's an exciting project, and I'm delighted to be here.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the sculptor who's creating Spike, who's this full life-size humpback whale in bronze.
That's correct. Well, R.T. Wallen, better known as Skip for all of his Alaska friends, I think he lived here in southeast Alaska for about 40 years. He is a world-renowned sculptor, and he's a gifted person. He's a visionary person, I think you'd have to say. And this whale has been something that we've been planning and working on for quite some time. And it will be a way that the viewer can capture that moment when the whale blasts through the surface of the water. Now, not everyone is able to see that or be out on the boat at the exact right moment. And, of course, our million viewers from the cruise ships over the summer, many of them don't get the chance to see that, too. So when you're standing in this park, and it's placed to be placed at Bridge Park, right by the bridge to Douglas, the viewer will have that opportunity to see that whale blasting through the surface and in a spray and fountain of water.
All right. How far along are you in site preparation? Is it pretty much set up the way you want it right now or not?
The plans for the site preparation are nearing completion. Rory Watt at the City Engineering been working hard on this with his whole team. The whale will come out of an infinity pool, which is 60 feet by 40 feet. And the infinity pool simply means that the water continuously runs over the edges, so you don't see a limit to it. And we expect the site to be prepared by spring of 2015, and then the sculpture itself should be arriving by June, early July of 2015.
Okay, who's shipping that in?
I think we have donations from.
I don't think it's coming on Alaska Airlines.
No,
is it?
It's not coming on Alaska Airlines. It's 501 parts, and we have two separate shippers who have donated. Let me ask Jim Clark, because he's involved in fundraising aspects, see if he knows anything about that part.
No, that's right. We have talked to two separate barging companies, and we have to move it from the foundry first to a spot in Oregon where it'll be picked up, and then it will be transshipped up to Juneau. And we've been very lucky to have donors willing to get it to us here.
All right. And will Skip be assembling it on site? Does he come up here for the final assembly?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right, fabulous. And this thing is, it's actually going to be 26 feet tall.
About 27 feet tall from rostrum to plinth, and the rostrum is the whale's nose or jaw, and the plinth is, you know, the top of the foundation for the whale. Yeah, just thinking about the other sculptures where I've had the pleasure of watching Skip put these in place is, anybody in Fairbanks will know the Lend-Lease Memorial with the 10-foot-tall Soviet pilot and 10-foot-tall American pilot in honor of the Lend-Lease, and that's up by Fairbanks, and I had the honor of being there when that was being placed.
All right, Jim, would you kind of recap some of the recent donations that have come in for the project?
Well, overall, this project is about $3.5 million, and we're down to the last $460,000. And I know that sounds like a lot, but we have been talking to a number of contributors. They always want to know, well, who's contributed so far? And we've had a $250,000 contribution from the Rasmussen Foundation. The Hickel family has given, the Alaska Airlines, just to name a few. We have a program whereby anyone who gives us more than $10,000 or $10,000 or more will have their name inscribed on a bronze plaque that will be adjacent to the whale, so that as the tourists come by and see what we've put together, they'll see who the major donors were. But we appreciate any donation. We've gotten, I'd say, thousands of donations from around the state, small donations that are extremely welcome. And we have a number of, we solicit all contributions, but it looks to me like we'll be able to wrap up our fundraising here, hopefully within the next 6 weeks.
And we'd like to drive people towards that wonderful website, AlaskaWhaleProject.org, so they can see all the details and ask any questions and send us an email or send us a donation.
Okay, and I know that there is a click and donate section on there, isn't there?
That there is.
All right, and there's also a Facebook webpage for the Alaska Whale Project, too.
That's right. We have that, and we used that when we did the Whale's Tail Trail, so that all those 10 resin whales that were created and are spread around over town. And I'd also like to mention that we're looking for one or perhaps two new board members, and we're looking for people with experience in public relations, fundraising, social media, and ask if anyone has any interest to please send an expression of interest to me, Kathy Ruddy, at 321-7558 or through the AlaskaWhaleProject.org. We have a very strong board, and we're just eager to expand by one or two members.
Okay, so anybody out there listening, if you want to support a really cool project,
thank you.
This thing looks really fabulous. You know, what's on the Whale Project webpage is just stunning. I mean, if it comes out looking like this, you know, I can see, you know, the background tricked in where it's all blue sky and stuff like that. I'm just trying to envision what it's going to look like when it's raining. maybe not quite as spectacular, but it really looks good. And on a sunny day, this is going to be just outstanding.
Rain helps the breaching effect, so it's not all bad.
Yeah, it helps the breaching effect. All right. All right, Kathy Ruddy and Jim Clark, thank you very much for being our first guests on the show today.
Thank you
for inviting us.
To be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been in his octopus's garden in the shade. I'd ask my friend to come and see. In the shade, we would be warm below the storm in our little hideaway beneath the waves, resting our heads on the seabed, in an octopus's garden near a cave. We would sing and dance around, because we know we can't be found. I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden in the shade. About the coral that lies beneath the waves. Oh, what joy for every girl and boy, knowing they're happy and they're safe. We would be so happy, you and me, no one there to tell us what to do. I'd like to be in an octopus's garden with you. In an octopus's garden with you.
And that was the Beatles with Octopus's Garden. I kind of ran that one to coincide with the Whale Project. Our next guest in the studio is Juneau Police Department Chief Bryce Johnson. And this is the third in a series of coverages of departments in the city and borough of Juneau. And I'd like to welcome him to the show. Bryce, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, and thanks for having me.
Okay, it's wonderful having you on here. And I'll just get into the questions right away. Bryce, since you started at the Juneau Police Department, you've consistently talked about wanting the department to be an open and trusted part of the community. Why do you think that's so important for us?
I think it's important because you have to have a partnership when you're talking about police work. There aren't enough police officers to be on every corner and enforce every law. It has to be we are dependent on voluntary compliance with the law. We're dependent on people calling and reporting things. We're dependent on witnesses. So we have a job we can do, but we cannot do it without the help of the community. And so we have to be a part of the community. We have to have the respect of the community. We have to be able to work with the community, because without that, you know, we see what happens without that.
Yeah, I know that sometimes the calls that come in get a little wacky. There was one last week where somebody reported a suspicious device, and it turned out to be a toy lightsaber.
That was a
that was a good one.
That was a funny call. You know, it came in as a suspicious device, and someone went out and looked at it and went, I have no idea what that is.
Well, they are rather suspicious. They're futuristic weapons from another galaxy.
And that's some duct tape around it. It didn't look just like
a lightsaber.
You make that decision. Am I willing to go shake that and see if it blows up? And most people say, no, I'm unwilling to do that. So we had one of our EOD officers go out and look at it, and he was like, yeah, this is... we're okay with this one.
All right. And in your mind, what's the best way to create a community policing culture in Juneau? And do you think we need a lot of work to get to that?
Well, I think we have a huge advantage over a lot of other jurisdictions, and that we are already a community that's together with their police officers. All of our officers live here in Juneau. They are the Juneau community. And you don't see that in a lot of other places. Most places, the police officers will live in a suburb, or they'll live somewhere where they're not policing. And one of the things I noticed when I got here is the officers, when they're interacting with the public, they are far more patient, far more they're patient. They'll ask 2, 3, 4 times. They do things that I never saw officers in other parts of the country doing. And I asked them why that is, and they told me, well, it's because I have to go to the grocery store with this person tomorrow. It's the cook at the restaurant I have to go to. It's my next-door neighbor. So we're advanced far beyond most places simply because all of our officers are already members of this community, and that makes a huge difference.
Yeah, Bryce, I understand that, because, you know, this is not a community where people sort of come in and go out of. Most of the people that are here are here on a permanent basis, and even with 32,000 people, it is somewhat of a isolated island-type environment where, yes, you do run into some people on a day-to-day basis, and it's not uncommon to run into people that, you know, that you'd see again and again routinely, even in the course of your job or off-duty.
Right. So I think we have that advantage, and the officers do a great job. We'll keep doing things to try to leverage that advantage. You know, our DARE program, I think, is a great example. We're going to do coffee with cops starting tomorrow. I think that's a great opportunity to interact more with the community and get their input. We did National Night Out, where we went around to neighborhood parties. We do a lot of outreach, which we try to build those connections. We also do it with other agencies, other non-governmental agencies. We try to partner with as many community organizations as we can to do the best job we can.
And does the philosophy of wanting the department to be an open and trusted part of the community affect the type of person that the police department might hire? And what is the process for candidate selection like?
It will always affect the people we want to hire. It's a comprehensive process. We want to be very careful about who we give the authority of the police officer to. They do carry guns and they walk around our streets. And before we do that, we want to make sure that we've vetted them properly. We start off with a written examination. After the written examination, there's an oral board interview where they have to get through a series of questions, kind of like you're giving me today. There's a physical test. We need them to both be mentally sharp but also physically capable of doing the job. Then there's a very detailed background investigation. We're going to look at what the person's done in their past and make sure we have a person that is a good citizen, that is exhibiting the core values which we have at JPD and exhibiting the values of law enforcement. We do some psychological testing also to make sure that you can deal with the some of the hard things you're going to end up seeing as a police officer. So we go through a very complete background investigation for people to make sure they're a good fit for us, and we don't want to put someone out that it's not going to be a good fit for them either. So it's a detailed background. It's a detailed process. At the end, I think we get some really good candidates.
Bryce, what do you think consumes the majority of your officers' time?
The majority of the time is in responding to calls for service. You know, people will call us for everything. We get called for domestic violence. We get called for thefts. We get called for traffic accidents. We get called for noise complaints. So the majority of the time is spent responding to things that the communities call up and saying there's a problem here, and we go and investigate and see what we can do. After that, the next thing that takes up most of their time is a proactive patrol. They'll go out and try to run traffic enforcement, to do speed enforcement, going to some of the locations where we know there's neighborhood problems, there may be some drug activity in a neighborhood or something like that. So they'll do proactive patrols and all those things. That's the next thing that takes up most of their time.
What would be the average number of officers on in the course of a day, like a day shift and then an evening, and then you've probably got a mid shift as well, right?
Right, and it depends on time of day. So in the daytime, there's usually at least four officers on. If we have a full shift and no one's on vacation, there would be six. During the weekend evenings, that number goes up we have two teams working at the same time during the evening hours, so we'll go up to about eight officers during those times.
And about how many are on the force currently?
We have 42 officers currently on the force. We're down 10 positions. So
choice or by budget?
Well, no, we have the budget for 52. So we everyone knows we expanded to take over operations at the airport, so we needed to hire for that. And we've got two officers at the academy right now who will be going to the academy till December, and then they'll come out and do some field training. And we have some other officers that are in the process of being hired. So we'll have that number whittled down.
Okay, for anybody that's listening and interested and meets those qualifications, are there any bids open right now?
We will do a test again next month. If they go to our website, there's a link there to public safety testing. We'll do an entry-level test next month, the written test and the PT test. And then we're always looking for lateral officers, people that are already certified police officers at other jurisdictions, and they can apply at any time.
Okay. Are there any pesky issues that keep coming up that the police department keeps getting involved in? I know that there's a little bit of a problem here with uninsured motorists. How do we address things like that and, you know, get people into compliance? Because you really don't know until you stop them and find out, hey, this person has no valid insurance.
Well, we just recently increased the fine for no insurance, and we hope that will be a deterrent for people to drive without insurance. You know, the goal is to, again, to get voluntary compliance. And so we hope that people will see the new fine and think, well, it's in my interest to pay for insurance on my car, because then I don't have to pay this ticket if I do get pulled over. We will not be able to stop everyone and check everyone for insurance. So we're going to rely on voluntary compliance, and hopefully this is a little bit of deterrence. Those people that we are able to stop and verify they don't have insurance, if they have to pay that new fine, that will deter them in the future from driving without insurance, and hopefully they tell all their friends, and their friends will be deterred from driving without insurance, because this is something that could affect anyone at any time, because most of us are out driving, a good percentage of us, and you just never know.
All right, Bryce, and are there any other instances like that where we've got things that are falling through the cracks that your department is trying to address?
I don't know if we have things falling through the cracks. You know, we get everything, and we have to prioritize them. So if the officers are all busy on a domestic violence call or something like that, we won't be able to do traffic enforcement and do the enforcement on no insurance until we're done with the calls that take a higher priority. So I don't know that we let anything fall through the cracks. We get to it. It's just a matter of prioritizing when we get to it and the order we get to it. So if you're in violation of any given law, you're eventually going to get caught for it, because the officers are very good at going out and doing that. And it's just a matter of prioritizing when and where we're able to do those enforcement activities.
Okay, and how closely do the dispatchers work with you guys? I mean, are they constantly on radio with you and letting you know what's coming up next?
They do. I actually saw a personalized license plate once that said, "My job is telling cops where to go." And it was a dispatcher's license plate. I thought it was kind of clever. So every time someone calls in, they talk to a dispatcher, and then the dispatcher will relay that to the officer in the field. And they have a great working relationship. You can tell that the dispatchers care immensely about the officers that they have out there. They have a connection with them when things happen. They worry about them. They stress for them when they're out in the field, and they do a great job of getting them the information they need and getting them where they need to go. They also dispatch for the fire department, so it's not just JPD they're dispatching for. They do a great job.
All right. And, yeah, I get that little saying, because air traffic controllers tell pilots where to go. So, I know where that one comes from. So the dispatchers tell you guys where to go. All right. Is there anything else that you want to add? Is there a website where people could go for more information if they're interested in applying to take the test, or just want a little bit more information about the people that serve their community?
Our website's at junopolice.com, and you can get a link there both to our hiring process, and there's a lot of information that's on that website. If you have any questions or information you need, you can go there to get it. And then I just like to remind everyone about our Cops and Coffee tomorrow at 9 o'clock, and be happy to sit down and talk with anyone that has any information for us or just wants to talk in general. We'll be down there to just talk to whoever comes.
And where's that going to be?
That's at Heritage Coffee in the downtown area.
Okay, very good. Bryce Johnson, Juneau Police Department Chief, thank you very much for being our guest on the show today.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 26th of August, 2014. It's the birthday of the man who wrote, "I am a camera with its shutter open, quite passive, recording, not thinking, recording the man shaving at the window opposite and the woman in the kimono washing her hair." Christopher Isherwood, playwright, novelist, born in Cheshire, England, 1904, emigrated to this country along with W.H. Auden, settled in Santa Monica, wrote for Hollywood films, became a follower of Hinduism, and started meditating, Isherwood said, "I'm tired of strumming on that old harp, the ego, darling me." It's the birthday of Zona Gale, the novelist, born Portage, Wisconsin, 1874, author of Miss Lulu Bett and Evening Clothes. Albert Sabin, born in Bialystok, Poland, 1906, to Jewish parents. The last name was Saperstein, changed it when he came to this country. He became the developer of the oral polio vaccine. At the University of Cincinnati, he proved that the polio virus entered the body not through the respiratory tract, as they had thought, but through the digestive tract. It's the birthday of the poet Guillaume Apollinaire, born in Rome, 1880, who said, "I love men not for what unites them, but for what divides them and for what gnaws at their hearts." 1748, on this day, the first Lutheran church body in America. German Lutherans settled in Pennsylvania because of William Penn's guarantee of religious freedom. And on this date, six pastors and delegates from 10 congregations met in Philadelphia. Elders from each congregation testified, and they complained that the services lasted too long, especially in the winter, and the preachers promised to strive after brevity. And it's the birthday of Barbara Ehrenreich, born in Butte, Montana, 1941, studied cellular immunology in graduate school, went to work in the field of public health, got involved with the women's health movement, and became a writer, author of the book Nickel and Dimed on Not Getting By in America, and most recently Living with a Wild God, A Non-Believer's Search for the Truth About Everything. Here's a poem for today by Clive James entitled Tramps and Bowlers. In the park in front of my place, every night a bunch of tramps sleep on the wooden porch of the Bowling Green clubhouse. They shed no light, no policeman ever wakes them with a torch, because no one reports their nightly stay. People like me who take an early walk just after dawn will see them start the day by packing up. They barely even talk loading their duffel bags. They leave no trace, thus proving some who sleep rough aren't so dumb. Tramps blow their secret if they trash the place. This lot makes sure that when the bowlers come, there's not a beer can to pollute the scene. And so by day, neat paragons of thrift and duty bow down to the very green which forms by night for scruffs who merely drift their front lawn. If the bowlers only knew, for sure they'd put in for a higher fence. They'd have a point, but it would spoil the view more than the tramps will if they have the sense to keep on cleaning up before they go, protecting indolence with industry, a touch of what the bowlers value so. Which way of life is better? Don't ask me. I chose both, so I'd be the last to know. Clive James's poem, Tramps and Bowlers, from Opal Sunset Selected Poems 1958 to 2008, published by W.W. Norton and Company, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Hi, this is Dan DiBartolo, the director for the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. Did you know that August 31st is the deadline for submitting required documents to the PFD office? It is also the cutoff for adding or changing voluntary contributions to the UA College Savings Program and PIGCLIC Give. Head to pfd.alaska.gov and click on the blue My PFD Info button to check your status or make contribution changes. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Revenue and aired by ABA and this station.
It's 3:34 p.m. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau. Juneau Afternoon continues. My next guest is a representative from the African Children's Choir. Her name is Sarah Lindstone, and she's the North American Choir Operations Manager. Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Ken, for having me.
Okay. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. And why don't you tell everybody about the organization and the history of the African Children's Choir?
Yeah, the African Children's Choir began in 1984, so we're just starting or looking forward to celebrating our 30th year as an organization. And the choir that will be coming to your area is number 41. So we've had 41 choirs over those past 30 years. And the way it started was our founder, Ray Barnett, he was doing some relief work in Uganda, and it was just after kind of a brutal reign of Idi Amin during that time, and just noticed the negative views that the West had of African children and the depravity there. And so he thought, you know what, there's actually a lot of hope and potential with these children if we can bring them to the West and change the West's view of these children and what help and support can do, and the dignity that these children do have, then we can really turn around this problem. And so that's kind of how it started, and it was just a great success from that first choir back in 1984.
All right, Sarah, how do you go about selecting performers for the choir?
Yeah, our biggest desire is to work with the children that do need the program the most. And we're more than just a touring choir. The purpose of the program is to provide education for these children and provide skills and basic needs for them. So we do go into communities and areas that provide the biggest need and work with community leaders there to find out, you know, what children really are not able to go to school regularly, have not had the proper basic skills provided or basic needs met for them. And then we audition those children, and you know, we look and see what kind of talents they may have with singing and dancing. But the greatest thing that we are looking at is what children do need the program the most, because we are going to provide them with education through right through college and university. So we want to really help those that do need it.
All right, Sarah, can you highlight some of the recent tours that you've had? Where has the choir been? And what ones do you consider to be the most successful?
Sure, yeah. This tour that is going to be coming through your area, they have they started in January. They started in California and have been spending lots of time on the West Coast, obviously all the way north, and they came through Canada. So they've had just a wonderful time. Obviously, these children have been able to see a lot of the U.S. and Canada, and are, you know, going to be enjoying even more of Alaska as they get to ride around on the ferries and see the various cities that you have to offer. And I know they've been enjoying the wildlife as well up there. But we've had all of our tours are just a wonderful success, with whether we're going into small communities or whether we are collaborating with bigger artists. And one of our recent stories was that the Queen of England celebrated her Diamond Jubilee in 2012, and we were able to be a part of that. She commissioned a song to be wrote for the celebration, and the African Children's Choir was selected to sing a portion of that song, and then invited to England, to London, to be able to sing for the Queen during a big concert celebration. And we're able to meet the Queen after the concert, and they obviously just enjoyed it and had a wonderful time. And that was just a wonderful opportunity to showcase the African Children's Choir on a very large stage.
Wow. Okay. That's pretty impressive. You get to meet the Queen. All right. And let's highlight the visits here in Juneau, because I know you've got four different concerts that are occurring over three different dates. So would you like
That's
to highlight those?
Yeah. We'll be at the Juneau Arts and Cultural Center on Friday, September 5th. That will be at 6 o'clock. And these concerts are, there's no ticket sales or fee, so anybody is welcome to come, and all are welcome. And then on Sunday morning, we'll be at Auk Bay Bible Church at 10 a.m., and then at Chapel by the Lake at 6:30. And then on Wednesday the 10th, we'll be at Church of the Nazarene at 7 o'clock. And there's also, those details are on our website, which is africanchildrenschoir.com.
Okay, that brings to mind, what do they get to do between, like, Friday and Sunday? They've got Saturday off.
Sure.
And then between Sunday and Wednesday, they've got Monday and Tuesday off. Are they, they're
for
obviously
sure.
still in the area, aren't they?
That's right, yeah. So on Saturday, we do like them to be able to enjoy a day off, and so they'll they do stay with families from the hosting church that is taking care of them. So they'll be able to spend a little bit more time and play with their host families on Saturday morning, and maybe their host families will plan an activity for them to do. And then on during the week, they are doing their school while they're on the road. So they will be doing classes and just doing some rehearsals as well. So that's what their Monday and Tuesday will be filled with while they're on their downtime.
Okay, that fills in that curiosity question. All right. how does the choir benefit African children as a whole? Do we? Is there a overwhelming benefit
for
that
sure.
we derive from that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple simple things is each of the children that are in the choir, I know that they are singing for so many other children that aren't traveling and coming to share their story with, especially Alaska at this point. So these children are sharing, and speaking on behalf of so many others that can't. And so just an awareness is one thing. And then also there are many relief and development programs that the African Children's Choir program works in several African countries. And so that's some basic needs that are met through education, through even life skills training and teachers college. So there's a lot more that goes on behind the scenes than just the choir that is showing up at the church on whatever day for the concert.
All right, Sarah, I'm just going to tell everybody that if they need to find some more information, you can go to www.theAfricanChildren'sChoir.com. So www.AfricanChildren'sChoir.com. And I'm sure that our dates are also on the website. You can just say, yes, they are. Okay. And, again, we've got four different concerts that are going to take place over 3 days. Beginning September 5th, you'll be able to see the African Children's Choir, and ending Wednesday, September 10th, here, right here in Juneau. Where do you go after you leave Juneau?
Juneau will be hopping on a ferry and heading to Sitka. And so we'll arrive really early in the morning on Saturday, September 13th in Sitka for a couple of days.
Wow, okay. So you're getting all over Southeast Alaska then, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Then we'll be on to Ketchikan, so they'll just get a good tour of the area.
All right, Sarah Lindstone, thank you very much for being our guest on the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
All right, and I want to play one song as we're going out here. This is the African Children's Choir from the CD Still Walking in the Light, and this song is called Standing for Heaven. And thanks again, Sarah, for being our guest on the show.
Thank you.
Nighttime falls on the lowly sky, the land falls to its knees. As children cry, the world wonders why many feet will say.
All right, that was the African Children's Choir with a song called Standing for Heaven from the CD Still Walking in the Light. And again, you can see them in early September here. They'll actually be here for four shows starting on the 5th. One reminder here, got to switch hats for a second. We're running Deep Impact at the Marie Drake Planetarium tonight at 6:30. It's the last in the retro sci-fi series, hosted by yours truly. The movie runs 2 hours. It's rated PG for a little bit of sci-fi violence and one or two things of foul language. I don't think there's much of that in there at all. But now I want to introduce my next guest, and he is Ted Wilson. He's the former Glacier Valley principal, and he's now the new teaching and learning director, and I'd like to welcome him to the show. Hi, Ted. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay, it's great having you on here. And you're going to be talking about the Juneau School District report card to the public. All right. How are we doing?
Well, we had good news, and so it's good to be here to be able to share some of the information from that good news. The state of Alaska, on its website, has released information about how schools fared last year on their assessments, and also some other things that they work into the data, attendance rate, graduation rate, how many students are taking the tests versus how many were able to take it. So they take all of those things and put it together into what they call the Alaska School Performance Index. You hear it called ASPE. And it rates public schools 1 to 5 stars on a scale. And that's based on the previous year's test performance and all those other things I just talked about. This is the second year that the state's used this system. And last year to this year, we showed growth at some of our schools, and so that was one of the things I wanted to highlight. Glacier Valley Elementary, River Bend, Yakuske, Dakahiti Alternative High School, and the Johnson Youth Center all went up in their star ratings, which was excellent news. All six of the elementary schools are now 4-star schools, and the Juneau Community Charter School and both Floyd Dryden Middle School and Zonta Kahini Middle School are also 4-star schools. So we have really strong results coming out of our elementary and middle schools. The high schools also were not left out. They have a harder time with the star rating because of all of the things that at the high school level comprise a star rating. But what they showed was that when it comes to their 4-year on-time graduation rate, they were both up and they're both very strong, especially when you look at them compared to the rest of the state. Thunder Mountain High School had a preliminary graduation rate of 89.74%, so almost 90% of their students graduating on time. And then JDHS had a preliminary graduation rate of 90.68%, which is excellent. And so both of those indicate growth over the previous year, and so we're showing improvement at all of our schools in comparison to the standards that we're being measured against.
All right. I'm a big advocate for education. I think that is the way for people to succeed. If you don't get skills, you're basically sunk. And getting that actual high school diploma is far better than the GED or good enough diploma. That's a lot of people call it that. But how do we as adults help children get to that level and succeed and at least get through the high school diploma and move on to a trade school or move on to college level?
One of the things that we know the adults need to do is they need to work together. And so that's been one of the big efforts of the Juneau School District is to have collaborative working groups of adults looking at our data that we collect both at the local level and then what we get back from the state on the various assessments we do for them, and look at what it is that the students need. And so at the elementary level, you're looking socially, what do they need? What do they need to feel safe and to be fed and, you know, meet all of those basic needs? And then you look at when they're reading and they're doing their math, what is it that they need for support to be successful at that level? Because at the elementary, you need to prepare them for middle school. Then at the middle school level, we're asking, again, the adults to work together to design a program that's going to meet student needs and also to look at when a student's struggling, what are you going to do as an intervention to help that student get the skills that they need to be ready for high school. And then when we get to high school, it's a whole new ball game when they reach high school, because now you're talking about credits that are required for graduation, and you're looking at students who are also looking at sports activities. They're looking at working outside of school, and so you're looking to see what needs you need to meet there. And so within the two comprehensive high schools, they're looking at how to present a schedule that's going to best meet the needs of students. But then if a student is struggling to keep up on their credits, what can you do to intervene to help them get the credits they need? Then the collaboration goes even further, because if a student, for whatever reason, isn't able to keep up with those credits, what can we do to support them? And Yakuske is one of those places at the alternative high school that we can provide support. Some students, for whatever reason, might be in another setting, and we need to also work to figure out how we're going to provide the best support there. So I'd say as far as the adults are concerned, we just need to make sure that we're working together, we're really looking at what students need and responding to that need.
Okay, and how do we factor in tutoring and mentoring into the equation?
Tutoring and mentoring is something that is another collaborative effort. United Way has a reading tutor program that we've been working, and it's one of those partnerships that you are always working with shifting needs, because you have to look at what tutors are available, where they're able to work, what the school district or the school in their schedule has working to make that come together. So you're collaborating to try to make that happen so that the community can also get involved with supporting a program like tutoring. Also putting into programs at each of the schools to support students. There was a grant at the high school level that ended last year that was supporting students in credit recovery. Now the high schools are working to try to do that in-house. But that grant moved to two of the elementary schools, Glacier Valley and Riverbend, and they're going to be working this year on bringing a lot of different community groups together to provide both enrichment activities to show students what some of the things are, you know, engineering, science, math, that they can be excited about and have a goal to, I want to be able to do that. And at the same time, working on developing skills that they need in reading or writing that maybe they're not up to par with their peers in the classroom. So it's always looking for ways to partner with the community.
All right. Well, and Ted, I asked you just jokingly, but just so everybody knows, this position as the new teaching and learning director is actually a step up for you.
It is. I started at Glacier Valley and was a teacher for 6 years, and then I was principal for 11 years, and then this summer took over as the director of teaching and learning. So technically, yes, it's a step up. Other folks would wonder if that really is, but so far I think that it's you know, when you're talking about working with adults to meet the needs of students, I like the work that I'm being asked to do.
All right, and we're glad that you do it. All right, Ted Wilson, thank you very much for the public report card, and thanks for being our guest on the show today.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. It's a lovely day along the California coast, near Big Sur. A steady, cooling breeze from the ocean pushes a strong updraft along the seaside cliffs. Soaring above is one of our continent's most spectacular birds, and one of its most endangered, the California condor. California condors are the largest soaring birds in North America, with a wingspan of over 9 feet. During the days of mammoths and saber-toothed cats, they thrived over much of the continent. 200 years ago, condors were found from California to southern British Columbia. But by 1987, there were only 27 California condors left, and these were held in captivity to foster the species' return to the wild. Today, there are more than 230 free-flying condors living in the wild and another 200-plus in captivity. Yet, the wild population is not self-sustaining. Unlike many species, the condor's main survival problem is not habitat loss. It's high mortality due to lead poisoning. Condors eat animal carcasses, often containing lead from hunters' bullets. But a state law passed in California in 2013 aims to eliminate the use of lead completely by 2019. That's a change that could enable condors to once again thrive and soar in the Golden State. Learn more at birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Linda Rosenthal from Juno Jazz and Classics. Don't miss an electrifying performance this Saturday featuring my friend, world-acclaimed cellist, Zua Bailey. Tickets are going fast, so get yours at jazzandclassics.org, Hearthside Books, or at the Jack Box Office. All proceeds benefit the 2015 Jazz and Classics Festival. Join me in a magical evening of music with virtuoso cellist, Zua Bailey, this Saturday, August 30th, 7:30 p.m. at the Jack.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, working with medical professionals to diagnose hearing disorders and prescribe solutions. Northern Audiology and Hearing Services. Information at 789-6780.
3:58 p.m. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau 104.3. Tonight's forecast is showers with isolated, this can't be right, thunderstorms in the evening. We don't ever get those. Patchy fog late with lows in the 40s and southeast winds at 10 miles an hour in the evening becoming light and variable. Tomorrow is mostly cloudy with a chance of rain. Highs in the upper 50s, light winds becoming northwesterly at 10 miles an hour in the afternoon. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, chance of rain, lows in the upper 40s with light winds. And you are listening to KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast on 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on the following translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay areas, K276 AF 103.1, Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listeners are on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear us on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also get us on KTOO GCI Digital Cable, Channel 871. And I hope to join you again next Tuesday. Here comes All Things Considered.
The situation really is a crisis. This is absolutely unprecedented.